Easter solstice, and today's opening words are by Diane Lee Mumy. Again did the earth shift, again did the days grow short and the nights long, and the people on earth were glad and celebrated each in their own ways. Let us not wish away the winter. It is a season to itself, not simply the way to spring. Winter dark tends to warm light, fire and candle. Winter cold to hugs and huddles. Winter want to gifts and sharing. Winter danger to visions, plans, and common endeavoring, and the zest of narrow escapes, and winter tedium to merrymaking. Now we'll share some silence and then some candle lighting.
I'm going to do something which is normally inexcusable, and that is cutting a poem, but this is a rather long one. The title is Brian, 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 and I'm not going to tell you what it's about, but it was written by Bachel Lindsay, describing his recollections as a very idealistic 16-year-old in a small town in Illinois in the election of 1896. In a nation of 100 fine, mob-hearted, lynching, relenting, repenting millions, there are plenty of sweeping, singing, stinging, gorgeous things to shout about and knock your old blue devils out. I brag and chant of Brian, 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 candidate for president who sketched to silver Zion, the one American poet who could sing outdoors. He brought in tides of wonder, of unprecedented splendor, wild roses from the plains that made hearts tender, all the funny circus silks of politics unfurled, Bartlett pears of romance that were honey at the cores, and torchlights down the street to the end of the world. There were truths eternal in the gab and tittle-tattle. There were real heads broken in the fustian and the rattle. There were real lines drawn, not the silver and the gold, but Nebraska's cry went eastward against the dour and old, the mean and cold. These creatures were defending things Mark Hanna never dreamed, the moods of airy childhood that in desert dews gleamed, the gossamers and whimsies, the monkey shines and didos, rank and strange of the canyons and the range, the ultimate fantastics of the far western slope, and of prairie schooner children born beneath the stars, beneath falling snows, of the babies born at midnight in the sod huts of last hope, with no physician there except a Kansas prayer, with the Indian raid a howling through the air. And all these in their helpless days are the dour East oppressed, mean paternalism making their mistakes for them, crucifying half the West, till the whole Atlantic coast seemed a giant spider's nest. Brian comes to Springfield. Then we stood where we could see every band and the speaker stand, and Brian took the platform, and he was introduced, and he lifted his hand and cast a new spell. Progressive silence fell in Springfield, in Illinois, around the world. Then we heard these glacial boulders across the prairie rolled. The people have the right to make their own mistakes. You shall not crucify mankind upon a cross of gold. And finally, they lose. Where is McKinley, Mark Hanna's McKinley, his slave, his echo, his suit of clothes? gone to join the shadows with the pomps of that time and the flame of that summer's prairie rose. Where is Cleveland, whom the Democratic platform read from the party in a glorious hour, gone to join the shadows with Pitchfork Tillman and Sledgehammer Altgeld, who wrecked his power? Where is Hannah, bulldog Hannah, low-browed Hannah, who said, "Stand pat," gone to his place with old Pierpont Morgan, gone somewhere with lean rat Platt? Where is Roosevelt, the young dude cowboy who hated Bryan then aped his way, gone to join the shadows with mighty Cromwell and tall King Saul till the judgment day? Where is Altgeld, brave as the truth, whose name the few still say with tears, gone to join the ironies with old John Brown, whose fame rings loud for 1,000 years? Where is that boy, that heaven-born Bryan, that Homer Bryan, who sang for the West, gone to join the shadows with Altgeld the eagle, where the kings and the slaves and the troubadours rest? The scene is frozen in our consciousness, one of the defining moments of modern America. Clarence Darrow heroically defending science and intellectual freedom by placing the champion of the forces of darkness and ignorance on the stand, forcing William Jennings Bryan to show to all the world that he believes absurdities, defends the indefensible, and uses his power to force others to do the same. You've seen the play. This yokel believes Adam and Eve were the first human pair, doesn't know or care where Cain got a wife, believes some sort of whale or fish swallowed Jonah. In short, the whole enchilada, whatever the Bible says, however absurd, however much in contradiction of science or even of itself, coming to your local school district to punish teachers for teaching biology, geology, physics, or history. The dragon, having been metaphorically slain by St. Clarence, obliges by dying on the spot, presumably from shame at having been publicly exposed as a charlatan. I'm afraid I'm going to make several demands on you today, and the first is to suggest that things are not always what they seem, that we have, in fact, merely caught a man of great and noble character at a bad moment. One of the rarities of Bryan's career was that before the Scopes trial, he had in 30 years lost many political races and crusades, but had steadily gained in esteem through them all. More than almost any other American politician, Bryan had the knack of losing the battles but winning the war. His causes were adopted one by one by people who had originally seen him as a dangerous radical. But in Dayton, things were reversed. As prosecutor, he won the case. While in the great court of public opinion, in the major newspapers of the day, and in the play Inherit the Wind, ultimately, he lost the reputation he had gained over a lifetime. Biographers have suggested mitigating factors. He was a terminal diabetic, and it is possible, say many, that he was in an advanced state of dementia by the time of the Scopes trial. We do know that he disapproved of laws like that of Tennessee, which he was, in fact, prosecuting because he disapproved of the punishment involved. He strongly preferred moral persuasion and disapproved the use of force. And he was not after the publicity. He was pushed by his followers to first into a position of national leadership as a fundamentalist, and then into helping to prosecute a violator of the law to which he had objected. But in the end, he saw his faith as being on trial and couldn't back down. But this isn't all there was to William Jennings Bryan. He was one of the greatest men of his time, and it is doubtful that any other American has ever made such a great positive impact upon our public life and then been so thoroughly forgotten. For the real story, we go back to the year 1896, a turning point in American history. After the Civil War, American cities and industries and railroads had blossomed, but the wealth created was concentrated into fewer and fewer hands. Prices were jacked up by high protective tariffs and the spread of monopolies. Labor conditions were abominable, with extremely long work weeks, widespread child labor, unsanitary and dehumanizing sweatshops, company towns that sucked workers' wages away faster than they could earn them, and wages depressed by seemingly endless streams of immigrants fleeing even worse conditions abroad. Attempts by workers to better themselves were bludgeoned to death by management-hired private thugs, as well as regiments of public thugs called up by governors who were beholden to the wealthy. And one of the grandest of these grand larcenies was the adoption of the gold standard in 1873. By removing silver as currency while withdrawing paper money from circulation, the plutocrats who ran the government systematically shrank the money supply over the course of two decades, even as the population and real wealth of the country exploded. The result was one of the greatest deflations ever. Debts incurred in the 1860s and 70s became far larger and harder to repay as time went on. If you want a sense of what it was like to live in that era, think of the massive housing deflation of the last 2 years, which has resulted in many, many houses being worth less than the mortgages that are still owed on them. And that may give you a sense of what it was like for Western farmers in 1896. And since the price of the monopoly-controlled goods weren't sharing in the fall, farm prices fell all the faster. Both major political parties were owned body and soul by the rich. We're accustomed to thinking of Democrats as the party of the left, but for half a century before this time, that had not been the case. There was one Democrat who became president, Grover Cleveland, the Michael Dukakis of his time, was going to rule just like the Republicans, but a little bit more efficiently. He created the civil service, and he had not the slightest clue about what to do about the human suffering that had come in general, and particularly from the Depression of 1893. Radical movements began to flourish. The Populist Party grew in the 1880s, like all American third parties, ultimately doomed to irrelevance and extinction. And as an aside, there's no such thing as a conservative populist, whatever the TV news people tell you or the pundits. You might as well talk about conservative progressives or conservative liberals. The Populist Party, in fact, these members were angry, but they were also intelligent, well-read, and as principled as the radicals who made the American Revolution. They were even the first and only party for a long period of American history to be able to bring Southern blacks and whites into a party of common interest. In 1896, because of economic conditions, the Democratic Convention had fallen into the hands of the radicals. They nailed together a platform calling for a progressive income tax, the control of monopolies, and a return to silver coinage as a way of halting deflation. Then they waited for a candidate. Bryan, the final speaker on platform issues, became man of the hour by delivering a speech for the ages. This was once a treasured statement of progressive American principles as much as the Declaration of Independence or the Gettysburg Address, and perhaps it should be again. from the concluding paragraphs. I come to you in defense of a cause as holy as the cause of liberty, the cause of humanity. Mr. Thomas Carlyle said in 1878 that this was a struggle between the idle holders of idle capital and the struggling masses who produce the wealth and pay the taxes of the country. And my friends, the question we are to decide is, upon which side are we? The idle holders of the idle capital, or upon the side of the struggling masses? This is the question which the party must answer first, and then it must be answered by each individual thereafter. The sympathies of the Democratic Party are shown by the platform, as shown by the platform, are on the side of the struggling masses who have ever been the foundation of the party. There are two ideas of government. There are those who believe if you will only legislate to make the well-to-do prosperous, their prosperities will leak through on those below. The Democratic idea, however, has been that if you legislate to make the masses prosperous, their prosperity will find its way up through every class that rests upon them. And to conclude, having behind us the producing masses of this nation and the world, supported by the commercial interests and the toilers everywhere, we will answer their demand for a gold standard by saying to them, you shall not press down upon the brow of labor the crown of thorns. You shall not crucify mankind upon a cross of gold. The campaign was far and away the most scandalous in American history. Republicans owned most of the newspapers then as now, and they painted Bryan in the most pejorative terms imaginable. A Jacobin, an anarchist, a socialist, a demagogue. He would have been a communist, except there wasn't a communist menace then. Mark Hanna extorted from Brighton businessmen a war chest, which in real terms was in the range of $200 to $500 million in a nation far smaller and poorer than our own. Standard Oil's contribution alone almost matched the entire Democratic campaign fund. Teddy Roosevelt made plans for a last military stand, if the Reds won. And John Hay made plans to rendezvous with other immigrants in Paris. A number of bosses told their employees not to bother to show up the next day if Bryan won. But all this should be the reaction to a candidate who brought back the words and ideas of Thomas Jefferson or Abraham Lincoln. Illustrates better than anything else the death grip which wealth had gained on America in 1896. In the end, the popular vote was close, the electoral vote less so, and Bryan lost. A pattern had been formed for his career. In 1900, new and massive gold strikes in the Klondike in South Africa had temporarily eased really brutal deflation. But in the aftermath of the Spanish-American War, we had become an imperial power in a world mad with colonialism. Bryan dared to campaign against imperialism, saying it was unworthy of America's ideals and suggesting that we should begin preparing our new colonies for self-government. He lost again, but in 1901, the accidental president, Teddy Roosevelt, became the first of Bryan's former political enemies to begin adopting his policies, which he rechristened as the Square Deal. A third principal defeat followed in 1908, but after Woodrow Wilson won in 1912 in a close three-way election, Bryan was appointed Secretary of State. Wilson was another of those former enemies, but he now calls for a new freedom, which was also straight from Bryan's platforms. As well as being Secretary of State, he was also instrumental in shaping several key domestic reforms, of which the most important was creating the Federal Reserve System. On most foreign policy issues, the President and Secretary of State thought alike. Their guiding principles were distaste for imperialism, respect for the autonomy of other countries, a desire to spread American values of democracy and human rights, and the attempt to create an international structure of law to curb war and other primitive national atavisms. As is the case today, some of those principles came in conflict with one another, and the level of intervention in the Caribbean and Central America almost matched the days of "we stole it fair and square" Teddy Roosevelt. Still, they laid a foundation for a future good neighbor policy and for supranational organizations to mediate disputes elsewhere. Only in one area did Bryan and Wilson disagree, and that finally led to the Secretary's principled resignation. He was a pacifist who rightly believed that Wilson's policies toward Germany would lead us into war. Interesting question. Which of them was right? Without American intervention, Germany would have won, and the result would have been an unpleasantly authoritarian Europe. But look at how events actually did play out. The imposition of a draconian peace treaty on Germany, which enraged its people, kept the economy weak, and the democratic government unpopular, while simultaneously the United States withdrawing from European affairs removed the only state capable of restraining Germany by force or by helping to resolve its grievances peacefully. So you were pretty much guaranteed some variant of Hitler in World War II. You can argue it would have been better if America had never entered World War I. And then finally, at the end of the war, Bryan's last failed political crusade was joining Wilson and attempting to persuade Americans to join the League of Nations. While he despaired of his failures, however, items from his agenda continued to be adopted. Direct election of senators, progressive income tax, women's suffrage, prohibition, a little iffy on that one, moving colonies to self-government, and states were adopting populist reforms like initiative, referendum, and recall. And after he died, Franklin Roosevelt, coming to power, abolished the gold standard, established a principled foreign policy in Latin America, and helped create the United Nations, which was what Bryan hoped the League of Nations could be. In short, much of the decent, middle-class, internationally respected America I grew up in had come as a result of the adoption of Bryan's campaign promises. But we are back to that strange period of his life, starting in 1921, when Bryan abandoned the world of politics and began to champion the teaching of bad science in the schools. It mystified his contemporaries among liberal reformers and has continued to baffle those who know enough about him not to be satisfied with Elmer Gantry or Pat Robertson-type caricatures. We talked about his illness and pressure from his followers, but we also know that he had come to believe that the evils he had been fighting his whole political life had been caused or exacerbated by the influence of one man. For the malefactors of great wealth, the monopoly-seeking capitalists, the gold standard purists, the imperial expansionists continued to expound a worldview in which what they were doing was natural and right and inevitable as they invoked the name of Charles Darwin. Darwin was a scientist, and his theory of evolution through natural selection is one of the great documents in the history of science. But the achievement did not take place in a vacuum. The 19th century was a period of rapid change. The development of industrial capitalism, huge corporations, the widening distance between wealth and poverty resonated with the notion that progress in the world came through savage competition. The very phrase, survival of the fittest, though Darwin adopted it, was actually coined by the English political philosopher Herbert Spencer and meant to apply to human culture. His basic premise was that government should stay out of the way and let human beings compete for survival as the only path to evolutionary improvement of the species. If the strong survived and the weak failed, then that was what nature intended. It was a very popular idea among the new industrial barons, and both Darwin's and Spencer's ideas were pushed and funded by them. Spencer's influence petered out pretty much after his death in Europe, but was in the United States, was later survived, thrived, and was later pushed by intellectuals like Ayn Rand and Milton Friedman. In Europe, in the meantime, Darwin's influence was used to justify other isms. There was German Premier Bismarck's theory of competition of nations, in which everything was settled by blood and iron. The Marxists saw the competition as being between the economic classes. And of course, everywhere in the United States and Europe, it was used to justify and promote racism. The military superiority of the West was proof that its peoples were more highly evolved and natural masters of the world. The lesser races were natural slaves. We group all these ideologies under a general designation of social Darwinism. A lot of these things would have taken place anyway, but there were abuses that were the direct result of popular beliefs about evolutionary biology. There was the pseudoscience of eugenics. Legislators, judges, and juries were persuaded to disregard their natural sentiments and authorize sterilization of the subhuman and unfit. Many of Bryan's enemies, including the social Darwinist H.L. Mencken, colorfully used the imagery of primates and subhumans to describe Bryan's followers. Thus it was that Bryan, who as a young man had been open-minded about the origins of humanity, came to be convinced that Darwin's theory was responsible for much of what was wrong with the modern world. The Darwinian theory represents man as reaching his present perfection by the operation of the law of hate, Bryan said. Evolution is the merciless law by which the strong crowd out and kill off the weak. He believed that the Bible countered this merciless law with the law of love. It was not any principle of biblical inerrancy that motivated him, but a desire to cut off a poisonous political philosophy at its root, to promote a national myth that would motivate the young to the highest ideals. He prepared himself as prosecutor not to defend the stories of Genesis, but to present to the court and world the image of Jesus as Prince of Peace. He was wrong, of course. And we have seen where his fundamentalist movement has gone. We have seen that all those nasty and malicious social Darwinists of the late 19th and early 20th century have adapted, evolved, mutated, whatever you want to use, taken on the protective coloration of religion. Now some of the most horrible teachings and policies, pretty much the same as prevailed amongst the social Darwinists then, are the bailiwick of fundamentalists. today. So I think if Darwin had seen how well his movement succeeded, he would be appalled. In the meantime, secular culture in the West has also changed. The horror of social Darwinist moralities finally climaxed in the 1930s and 40s, when perhaps 100 million human beings were murdered in Nazi and communist atrocities and in World War II. There has been a massive reaction in the West ever since. For much of the second half of the last century, it was impolite in many intellectual circles to imply that any human characteristics beyond eye, hair, or skin color might be due to genetics. Thus, secular culture in both Europe and America has become, in general, more progressive than Bryan's fundamentalist Christians have become. At the same time, the popular understanding of evolutionary biology is better grounded. Natural selection never involves survival of the fittest within hunter-gatherer tribes, but rather pushed trust and cooperation to form cohesive groups that could protect and educate children. The objective, after all, is to produce the next generation. And since individuals never had to survive on their own, these tribes were able to carry with them a much wider variety of genetic traits, and this in turn has given the human species much more flexibility in adapting to different environments. So the diversity of our gene pool is a blessing, advantage for humanity, not a curse that needs to be weeded out. And until recent time, there was very little or no competition for survival among the tribes, which were scattered too thinly to interact at all. So nationalism or racism could never have been factors in human selection. Thus, the major tenets of social Darwinism have no basis in actual human evolution. It was an idea that emerged from a particular culture and economic system, not from any insight into the reality of human nature. And Bryan, too, was a product of his time. He is nonetheless worthy of our highest respect, with all his flaws. And I would like to end with the words of Henry Steele Commager. Defeated candidates are usually forgotten and lost causes relegated to historical oblivion, but Bryan was not forgotten, and the causes which seemed lost triumphed in the end. He refused to acknowledge defeat, not out of vanity or ambition, but because he was sure the causes he championed were right, and sure that right would triumph in the end. And right or not, most of them did. Few statesmen have ever been more fully vindicated by history. Item by item, the program which Bryan had consistently espoused from the early 90s on into the new century was written into the statute books, written into law by those who had denounced and ridiculed it. Called a list of reforms: government control of currency and banking, government regulation of railroads, telegraph and telephone, trust regulation, the 8-hour day, labor reforms, the prohibition of injunctions in labor disputes, the income tax, tariff reform, anti-imperialism, the initiative, the referendum, women's suffrage, temperance, international arbitration. They were not all original with Bryan, but it was Bryan who championed them in season and out, who kept them steadily in the political forefront, who held his party firmly to their advocacy. For Bryan was the last great spokesman of the America of the 19th century, of the America of the Middle West and the South, the America of the farm and the country town, the America that read the Bible and went to Chautauqua, distrusted the big city and Wall Street, believed in God and the Declaration of Independence. He was himself one of these people. He thought their thoughts and he spoke the words that they were too inarticulate to speak. Above all, he fought their battles. He never failed to raise his voice against injustice. He never failed to believe that in the end, justice would be done. Others of his generation served special interests and special groups. Others were concerned with the getting of office or of gain. He was zealous to advance human welfare. And when the rest are relegated to deserved oblivion, the memory of Brian will be cherished by the people in whom he had unfaltering faith.
If here you have found freedom, take it with you into the world. If you have found comfort, go and share it with others. If you have dreamed dreams, help one another that they may come true. If you have known love, give some back to a bruised and hurting world. Go in peace.